The next case is 03-487, State of Ohio versus George Skates. Ms. Shank.
I've been waiting for water. Mr. Chief Justice, your honors. Good morning.
See if you can pull the mic towards you a little. We're having still fine-tuning our system here. And then put this part up like that. Okay, that may help.
Good morning.
That's better.
I would like to reserve 7 minutes for my rebuttal. May it please the court. The facts of this case arose during the course of the uprising at the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility in April of 1993. George Skates was convicted of 3 aggravated murders and 3 kidnappings. He was sentenced to death for 2 of the aggravated murders. The state acknowledged at trial that there is no physical evidence linking Mr. Skates to any of these crimes. In the absence of physical evidence, the state used conspiracy evidence to establish at least one element in every single charge. We have presented and briefed before this court 60 propositions of law, many of which have subparts or list multiple examples of individual errors. Each of those independently warrants relief. Cumulatively, they present a picture of overwhelming injustice. That said, there are 2 errors that underlie many of the problems that arose during trial and influenced the case, causing prejudice and confusion throughout. Those are the inadequacy of the indictment and the misuse of conspiracy law. It is those issues that I will address today. The indictment in this case is inadequate on its face. On its face, the indictment charges aggravated murder during the course of a kidnapping. The kidnapping victim is not identified. The kidnapping statute is not cited. The elements of the kidnapping are not revealed. This is in a case where the state acknowledged that there were hundreds of kidnapping victims. The prosecuting attorney in his argument said in closing that the pictures shown of the 400 inmates that were within that institution, each one of them was potentially a kidnapped victim. Without naming the victim of the kidnapping, no one, whether an innocent person served with an indictment elsewhere or a person standing in the middle of the riot, knew what charge was being faced. The same defect exists with the kidnapping death specification. No victim is identified, no crime elements are identified, not even the statute. There are 3 kidnapping charges. In those charges, the victims are identified. Those victims are not the same victims as the murder victims. Therefore, there is no possible inference that necessarily the victim named either as a victim of kidnapping or as a victim in the specification is necessarily the same victim as the person named in the murder charge. So murder victims and kidnapping victims do not equate in this indictment. In the kidnapping charges, all of the potential purposes for kidnapping are listed using the statutory language only in the alternative. One of those is critical in this case. That is for the purpose of committing a felony. The felony is never named. Just the generic word felony is used. This indictment on its face fails to give notice of the crimes faced. Significantly, the problems do not end there. The indictment further fails to give adequate information for someone to face the charges that the state presented. The state pursued conviction in this case on a theory that Mr. Skates engaged in a conspiracy, thus making him complicit, thus making him guilty as a principal. That building block pattern is acceptable under the terms of Ohio statutes.
He received a bill of particulars, did he not? He requested and received a bill of particulars?
He did receive a bill of particulars, Your Honor. And in the bill of particulars, and this fits in with the conspiracy aspect of this, the conspiracy identified as the one and only conspiracy was to commit aggravated riot. That conspiracy, of course, cannot serve as the basis for a conviction for aggravated murder. Under the terms of the conspiracy statute, you must be conspiring in the same crime that you ultimately would be convicted for. Under the terms of the complicity statute, you must be conspiring in the crime for which you will ultimately be held accountable as the principal. So you can't be guilty of conspiring to commit aggravated riot and thus complicit in an aggravated murder and therefore guilty as the principal of an aggravated murder. The bill of particulars said conspiracy to take over L Block. So the only information provided something that was inapplicable and not usable under Ohio law. Despite that bill of particulars and the use of the aggravated riot statute, as well as the use of conspiracy, made this case one of utter chaos. From the beginning of the trial throughout it, no one really understood what was being charged. The prosecuting attorney in the bill of particulars named aggravated riot as the basis of a conspiracy. Later on, the prosecuting attorney talked about aggravated riot as being the basis for a conspiracy and an underlying kidnapping for Mr. Vallandigham, but decided that there were conspiracies to commit aggravated murder, never before mentioned, with regard to the others. 5,000 pages almost into the transcript, the prosecutor was trying to introduce hearsay evidence. The trial judge, when there was an objection, the trial judge questioned it. The prosecutor said, "We've got to prove a conspiracy to commit aggravated riot in order to introduce a whole bunch of hearsay." The trial judge said, "Yes, but they are not on trial for aggravated riot." By the time it came time to give jury instructions, it turned out that, in fact, the court had decided that Mr. Skits was on trial for aggravated riot and instructed the jury that aggravated riot was the felony underlying the purpose for the kidnappings. The court also instructed not that aggravated riot was the basis of the conspiracy, because by then it appears that they had figured out that you can't do that. But now, contrary to what the bill of particulars said, instructed the jury that the conspiracy could be one to commit either kidnapping or aggravated murder. So the character of this trial, from beginning to end, was altered and confused because the indictment failed to provide adequate information. This is the beginning of the misuse of the conspiracy law in Ohio. The second aspect of it comes into play in the introduction of co-conspirator testimony. The state had no physical evidence and admitted it. Its entire case was based on the introduction of testimony from inmates, the bulk of which came in through co-conspirator exceptions. There are multiple problems with this evidence. First, The proponent of the evidence is required to make a prima facie showing that the defendant is a party to the conspiracy and that some overt act had taken place. It's a prima facie showing. The court could never make a determination as to whether such a showing was made because the court never knew what conspiracy was at issue. Had there been proper limiting recognition of what conspiracy was being used to introduce what testimony from which inmate, the evidence would have been severely limited. We would have been confronted with a situation where rulings that were against the defense would certainly have ended up being in their favor, and much of the hearsay that came in would not be present. In addition to this, there are some substantial issues about the conspiracy exception in 801D2E, which allows co-conspirator testimony and recognizes it as not being part of the hearsay exclusion. That rule requires, pursuant to its comments, that the conspiracy be charged. It also is apparent, based on the law in Ohio and the use of the rule, that the conspiracy must be a crime. There is no conspiracy to commit aggravated riot that is a crime in Ohio. The conspiracy statute limits the crimes for which conspiracy can be charged, and aggravated riot is not among them. If you don't have the conspiracy charged, and if the conspiracy is not a crime, the indicia of reliability that warrant the hearsay exception are not present. I point out to the court that one of the clear indications beyond the staff comments to the rule that the conspiracy must be charged is the fact that for the introduction of co-conspirator testimony, there is only a requirement that there be a prima facie showing. Even for other acts evidence, we require more. We have to have substantial evidence that the act was committed by the defendant to introduce other acts.
Counsel, you're doing very well here in terms of educating us to the evidentiary problems. Let me take you to the end of the trial. Did the trial court, who you've said was confused as to what it was the prosecution was setting out to prove, and therefore allowed evidence in that it shouldn't have. At the end of the trial, did the trial court have it figured out and give the proper charge to the jury in terms of what it is that the defendant could be convicted of or found not guilty of?
The answer to that, Your Honor, is no. Although the court did ultimately apparently realize that you could not use aggravated riot as the basis, what the court did was that it instructed that in order to find that the defendant conspired, you must find beyond a reasonable doubt that on or about the dates charged, the defendant with purpose to commit aggravated murder or kidnapping, either one planned, etc. The court gave the jurors a choice. The court never instructed that to find conspiracy, thus complicity, and thus guilt of aggravated murder, the conspiracy had to be to commit aggravated murder. And the court never instructed that to find conspiracy to commit kidnapping, and thus complicity in kidnapping, and thus guilt as a kidnapper, that the conspiracy had to be to commit kidnapping. That instruction was never given. The only instruction gave them a choice. So the jurors never knew. In light of
So the problem is, or was, there's plenty of evidence that these inmates conspired ahead of time to do this riot. The evidence that they had murder in mind was, I assume, fairly sketchy or non-existent to when this started to unfold. Would that be correct?
Well, Your Honor, there is plenty of evidence that the aggravated riot, if you want to characterize it as that, was planned. There is no evidence that George Skates was involved. In fact, the evidence shows that he did not know of it until it began to take place. And that, I want to just mention briefly, relates to another error in the jury instructions. George Skates did come back into the prison, and he did perform a role as a negotiator. We have set out our sufficiency of the evidence and the other issues in the brief, so I won't go into that. But what's important about your question is that Mr. Skates wasn't involved in the pre-planning. He came back in to negotiate and to help people and became, at least ostensibly, involved in the state's view as a co-conspirator in a riot at that point. The jury instruction on conspiracy went on to say that you may not find that the defendant conspired with others to commit an offense unless you find it beyond a reasonable doubt that a substantial overt act in furtherance of such conspiracy is proved to have been done by him or by a person with whom he conspires, and that such an act was not performed subsequent to the defendant's entrance into the conspiracy. In this circumstance, where the evidence is clear that the conspiracy to commit aggravated riot did not include George Skates, took place long before the day the riot started, and took place among others, it is extremely likely that the jurors read that, heard that, and said, okay, those guys did the overt act, and when Skates came back in, that makes him a conspirator. That word wasn't is the exact opposite of what the law requires. The overt act must have been performed subsequent to his entry. So, yes, there was a lot of evidence of conspiracy to commit an aggravated riot. Pre-riot, George Skates is not in any way implicated. With regard to the questions of his guilt, we believe that the state failed in every respect once you exclude all the inadmissible hearsay evidence to prove any of the charges against Mr. Skates. In addition to the conspiracy issues that I have mentioned, Your Honors, I want to say something about the conspiracy law because there seems to be confusion or at least question about whether or not Ohio really requires that the conspiracy be charged for the admission of that evidence. In the course of preparing for this argument, and it is cited in our additional authorities, I found a case from long ago. The judge who sat on that case was Chief Justice John Marshall of the United States Supreme Court, sitting at the district court level in the trial of Aaron Burr for his efforts to bring a military expedition against the King of Spain, a nation at peace with the United States. In the course of that highly political, very notorious trial, the state wanted to introduce co-conspirator testimony, even though the conspiracy hadn't been indicted. And Justice Marshall said, I have not been able to find in the books a single decision or solitary dictum which would countenance the attempt that is now made to introduce as testimony the declarations of third persons made in the absence of the person on trial under the idea of a conspiracy where no conspiracy is alleged in the indictment. As the arguments went on, he said, I know not on what ground to dispense with charging in the indictment the combination intended to be proved, if this combination may be proved by the acts or declarations of third persons made in the absence of the accused because he is connected with those persons, if in consequence of this connection the ordinary rules of evidence are to be prostrated, it would seem to me that the indictment ought to give some notice of this connection. The federal courts have not ruled on whether or not conspiracy must be indicted. The lower courts are divided. But this, though not technically a United States Supreme Court decision, I think demonstrates the real considerations in this case with regard to the testimony that was introduced. Chief Justice Marshall had it right. The Ohio Rules of Evidence have it right, and it should have been done right in this case. So I think the conspiracy testimony is a critical factor here and that we definitely need to exclude it. I will now reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Shank. Mr. Breyer.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. Before I respond to the legal issues raised by Ms. Shank, I would like to make two comments about her opening remarks. And her first opening remark was that this was a case in which there was no physical evidence, in which the state's prosecution was based on just testimony from other inmates and other witnesses. And of course, there's nothing wrong with relying on that type of testimony. But the fact is, I guess it depends on how you define physical evidence, but before the court, there are two different types of audio tapes. One set was called the tunnel tapes, and those were made when the FBI ran microphones up through the concrete floor of L Block. And one of those microphones turned out to have been placed in the L2 administrative office area where the riot leaders held their meetings. The other group of audio tapes are the negotiation tapes. And those were the tapes wherein the inmates communicated with the authorities during the course of the riot. And those tapes were all, not all of them, they were all available for the defendant, but quite a few of them were used in evidence. But with regard to these tunnel tapes, George Skates is all over the tunnel tapes. He is caught in riot leadership meetings, making decisions and making plans to commit these crimes and further the course of the conspiracy. So it's not just the word of other inmates. He is on these tapes. He is also on the negotiation tapes. And on the murder, on the day, on the morning of April 15th, the day that Officer Vallandigham was killed, there's a combination of tunnel tape and negotiation tape. On the tunnel tape, one of the riot leaders suggests that we will not get any results until we send a body out there. We call him, we tell him you've got 30 minutes or else a dead man. And lo and behold, later that morning on the negotiation tapes, George Skates is heard saying, after a few profanity-laced sentences, if you don't turn that water on, it's a guaranteed dead man in 30 minutes. So this evidence is not just inmates coming in to get even with George Skates. There's tape evidence, he is on the tape, he incriminates himself on the tape. Second point,
well, no, that comment is his threat and not his communication. Was he a negotiator in some of this?
The first tape I referred to was a tunnel tape on which the riot leaders are discussing killing a guard to achieve a benefit.
Right.
The second tape is a negotiation tape in which Mr. Skates tells the authorities, give us what we want or we're sending out a guard dead. The second point the counsel made is that this trial somehow was chaos, I believe was her word, that it was chaotic, that the state had multiple shifting theories, that's the language from her brief, of what was going on. And that, Your Honors, is just totally false. The Court of Appeals dealt at length with that claim. They went through it. They pointed to page numbers throughout the record where the state was totally consistent in all its points throughout the trial. And in the end, they came to a conclusion. They said, far from chaotic, the state's approach and conduct of this trial was extremely focused. I just have to rebut those two particular claims. This particular case is not one that really lends itself to oral argument. There are 60 propositions of law. A lot of them have multiple components. One of them has 50 different claims in it. Another one has 35. Many of them have at least 10. So it's hard to focus down on something to argue about and ignore everything else. But counsel here has limited herself to two particular points.
Yeah, could you address what counsel for the defendant is claiming that there's a defective indictment.
Yeah. The first point that counsel made is that the indictments are defective. And that was the lead argument in the Court of Appeals, and again, it was the lead argument presented here. It's raised in the first five propositions of law, and it's mainly focused on the use of the kidnapping as it appears in each of the counts. And her argument is that the elements of kidnapping should have been listed, the section number should have been placed in there, the victim should have been named, and that the evidence the grand jury relied on should have been in the indictment. Well, I don't think that those are serious issues because Ohio law on the wording of indictments is well settled. As long as the indictment is in the word of the statute, it is sufficient. If the defendant has a problem, his remedy is with a bill of particulars. And the Court of Appeals went through this. They cited all the cases from this court that hold that. And it's true. The indictments here are in the word of the statute. They track the statutes. They are not defective in any way. Now, the defendant did ask for a bill of particulars, and she was given one. And that bill of particulars was a document the state was consistent with throughout the trial. There were no surprises to this defendant, and I hate to make this argument, but I have to. This court has previously reviewed the conviction of Jason Robb. Like Mr. Skates, he was a leader of the Aryan Brotherhood gang that participated in this particular riot. And I'm not talking about the wording of the indictments here, but the other claim she raised has to do with the 801D2E co-conspirator exception. All the issues that she raises here concerning conspiracy testimony were raised in the Robb case. And they've already been decided by this court, and they've been decided adversely to the position offered here by Ms. Shank here. The co-conspirator testimony is admitted pursuant to the evidence rule. It is not dependent upon a crime of conspiracy being charged. There is Ohio case law on that. Robb itself mentions that. But in its decision, the Court of Appeals listed three or four Ohio cases which deal with that very issue, that you do not need to charge the crime of conspiracy for the co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule to be applied. Again, I think both of these two main issues that she is raising are not difficult issues. They're issues that have been resolved by this court numerous times. The wording of the indictment, I believe, is that issue is extremely well settled. The same is true of the co-conspirator issue. It's inaccurate to state that the crime of conspiracy must be charged before the co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule comes into play. That is inaccurate. Counsel also referred to a remark by the prosecutor that we're establishing a conspiracy so that we could admit a whole bunch of hearsay. That was just an offhand remark, not in front of the jury, to the judge, explaining what was going on, why they had to do this. And when he said hearsay, he obviously meant pursuant to the co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule. Again, I do not think, unless I'm completely missing the boat here, that either of those two issues are major issues. They're issues that are well settled. They've been covered by this court before. A lot of the evidence that counsel is referring to is hearsay, is evidence that was admitted to lay the foundation for the admission of co-conspirator testimony. Because remember, this was an 11-day riot. A lot of crimes occurred. A lot of things were done in there. The conspiracy that was the subject or that was the foundation for the admission of the co-conspirator testimony was a conspiracy among the three inmate gangs to seize control of the prison, take revenge on people they didn't like, and take hostages in order to force concessions from the Department of Corrections.
Was this defendant a part of that conspiracy?
Yes, absolutely. He was the leader of the Aryan Brotherhood gang. They were in on this from the very beginning. They were the main weapon suppliers in the prison.
The defense argues here that he was not a part of the original conspiracy.
There's no question that the idea of a riot originated with the Black Muslim gang. The purpose was to resist tuberculosis testing.
Right.
But in order to carry out the riot, they enlisted the aid of the Aryan Brotherhood and the Black Gangster Disciples. And that aid, particularly the aid of the Aryan Brotherhood, was enlisted before the riot actually kicked off. So he was in on it, although it originated with the Muslims, the AB was in on it.
You're stating that that's part of the evidence in the case, not your theory of the case.
No, that's the evidence that'll be, you know, when you read this record. I'm sure probably the vast majority of the judges on this court took part in the Robb decision, and this won't come as any surprise. It's a virtually a replay of the Robb case.
Is that on the tapes, that evidence, is that or not? The Skates's participation at the early stages, the planning stages of it. Do we find that in the tapes, or is that?
That's not going to be on the tapes. That will not be on the tapes, because the tapes obviously didn't come into existence until after the beginning of the riot. Anyway, the point I was trying to make is that a lot of evidence that is being characterized as hearsay was admitted to lay the foundation for the co-conspirator exception, because the state had to prove the existence of the conspiracy, who participated in the conspiracy, that the defendant participated, that any particular declarant participated in it, and of course that it was during the course of and in furtherance of the conspiracy. And a lot of the evidence being characterized as hearsay was not, and it was admitted for that purpose. The only final point I want to make in argument is to touch on the last point that counsel made, and that had to do with the jury charge. In particular, it had to do with was and wasn't. As this court will become aware, this case has been on appeal for a long time. It was tried back, I believe, in 94 or 95, and it took about 7 years to get through the Court of Appeals. And the vast bulk of that time was made up trying to perfect the record. The various imperfections, the court reporter had left town before completing her task. Some of the exhibits were missing. So the Court of Appeals went through a very lengthy, laborious process and virtually reassembled all the missing items. But during the course of this, the state, because counsel obviously noticed it alertly and raised it as a claim of error, that there was a sentence in the conspiracy charge that said, and an act wasn't committed subsequent to involvement, and of course the word should have been was. The state contacted the court reporter who we found in Oklahoma, and she said, yes, wasn't reflects what I have in my notes. But we then observed that throughout that portion of the trial, the court told the jury and counsel, he gave counsel written instructions. He told the jury they would be given written instructions and they should rely on the written instructions. He specifically emphasized to them, you must rely on the written instructions which you will be given. So at that point, the state recovered a copy of those written instructions and supplemented the record with it. So in fact, the record reflects that the jury was given a charge that contained the correct language, was, and not the incorrect word, wasn't. And that is the subject of one of the supplemental entries that the Court of Appeals put on prior to its final decision. You'll see there's multiple entries in here dealing with the state of the record, and that was dealt with in one of those records. But the only point I want to make is the jury had the correct language in front of them when they deliberated. Unless the court has any other questions, I have nothing else to add.
Thank you, Mr. Breyer.
Thank you.
Ms. Shank, you've saved 11 minutes of your time.
I think I'll try to work backwards with regard to what was just said. The instruction that I have highlighted with regard to the jurors being told that they were going to get copies of the written jury instruction says, you will have a copy of the charge back in the jury room in case you wish to peruse it. It's not a requirement that they review it, and there is no evidence that they ever did. The only evidence, the only record before this court of any instruction that we know with absolute certainty was heard by the jury is the one that told them that the act, the overt act, was not performed subsequent to Mr. Skates joining into the conspiracy. So the only thing we know, and we cannot know what happened in that jury room, but presumably, had they read an instruction that was inconsistent with what they'd been told by the judge, there would have been a question, and there wasn't. So, with regard to that,
Counselor, are you saying that there is no record that the judge instructed them that the written jury instructions were what they were to utilize?
Your Honor, because we're acting quickly, I do have the jury instructions here, and there may be an earlier one. I am not going to make that representation until I have a time to absolutely review.
Well, the representation
review
you just made was the only thing the judge told them to do was peruse it. Are you saying that there's no other language spoken by the judge instructing them on the written documents they were taking into the jury room with them?
Your Honor, I'm saying that until I have a chance to review the entire thing, I won't represent that that's the only instruction he gave. He did give that instruction. I'm reading from them. But I will try to find quickly, and I'm sure my co-counsel's looking as he's sitting there at the desk, if I can find anything more than that. But for the moment, even if the judge told them to take them, and even if, let's assume that he told them to take them, we don't know that they read them. We have not one iota of evidence supporting that. And we have the very clear indication that they did not read a conflicting jury instruction, because had they done so, they surely would have said, Your Honor, you told us one thing, this says something else. Which one's correct?
Wasn't there a presumption there that they recalled in the jury room during deliberations what the judge spoke from the bench in the reading of the erroneous word wasn't instead of was? I mean, you're making quite a leap there to presume that.
Well, we presume that jurors follow the instructions given to them by the court in every case. And there have been many decisions made throughout the history of law where we've decided that juries who only had spoken instructions were able to and did follow them. I have no evidence, and there is none in this record, that indicates that this jury was not listening, did not pay attention, and failed to follow the judge's oral instructions. And we have no evidence that they read the instructions that were given to them.
We don't have any evidence either way.
Correct. Okay. And in light of the fact that the only existing evidence says they were given the wrong instruction, it seems fairly clear that we must rely on the fact that they used the only instruction we know they got. With regard to Mr. Breyer's characterization of the evidence of the conspiracy prior to the beginning of the riot, the Aryan Brotherhood membership that he relies on is in fact not proof that George Skates was involved in a conspiracy. What that is membership in an organization. You don't get to have guilt by association. We've addressed the United States Supreme Court decision in Dawson on that point. There is no evidence in this record that George Skates participated in any discussion, any weapons gathering, anything about the riot prior to the day it began. None. The fact that he was a member of the Aryan Brotherhood is not evidence of that and cannot be used for it, not only because it violates the Constitution to infer guilt by association, but also because to be a member of a conspiracy, you do have to commit an overt act in furtherance of it. And there is no evidence that George Skates even knew about it, let alone committed any overt act prior to the time that the riot began. So the Aryan Brotherhood membership is a non-issue and certainly is not evidence. The second part of this is the reference to the Robb case as being dispositive on any issue in George Skates' case. This court did address very briefly the question of co-conspirator testimony in Robb. I take it from the writing of the opinion only that many of the issues addressed in here were in fact not addressed in that case and in that briefing. But more importantly, in the discussion in Robb, this court refers only to conspiracy to commit aggravated murder. Conspiracy to commit aggravated murder is at least a crime. The conspiracy used in this case was a conspiracy to commit aggravated riot. It's not a crime, and it cannot be a crime. And that all by itself changes anything between this case and Robb. So the Robb case is not dispositive in any way with regard to any of the issues that we've addressed. Excuse me. Your Honor, because we don't have time to go through all the jury instructions, I would ask that we be able to supplement on that if the court would like us to, you know, further supply cites to the record.
We'll advise you if we want that supplemental.
Okay, thank you. With regard to the many other issues in this case, the indictment simply is not clear. And I want to point out to the court a couple of the places where I think confusion that Mr. Breyer thinks is not evident actually is. In the state's closing argument discussing the kidnapping of Robert Vallandigham at page 5660 of the transcript, they say that the kidnapping was for the purpose of committing aggravated riot. Later on, the state says that the kidnapping was for the purpose of committing aggravated, I'm switching to Elders and Summers. And the aggravated riot was used for all three. Later on in the case, the state decided that the aggravated riot, Your Honor, this is a confusing case simply because of all the charges, that the kidnapping was committed for the purpose of committing aggravated murders. Then, in the jury instructions, which I have already read to you from the court decided that we had the possibility of conspiracies to commit aggravated murder or kidnapping. So we tell the jurors from opening statements to closing argument to jury instructions, different combinations of aggravated riot conspiracies and aggravated murder conspiracies. And then we get to the jury instructions and suddenly we add in a kidnapping conspiracy that's not been discussed. On top of that, the conspiracy identified in the bill of particulars, which by the way cannot be used to correct a defective indictment, but if the state provides the information for clarification purposes and the defense relies on it, they must be bound by it. That conspiracy was one to commit aggravated riot. We have conflicting and confusing references to the conspiracies. Mr. Breyer made it sound as if there might not be a consistent usage of aggravated riot by the prosecution throughout this. And I want to point out to the court that, again, later in the case, and I have my page marked, but it's in the 4000s. There's another discussion about the possibility of using, of introduction of hearsay testimony. And once again, the prosecuting attorney says, we are allowed to use this because this is proof of the overall riot conspiracy. The confusion in this case is not just in the defense. It is not just in the prosecution's shifting theories of culpability. It's not just in the absence of clear decision-making on the court's part for admitting evidence. It's in the jury instructions themselves. There is no way to review this case fairly and understand what the jurors found. We cannot know with certainty that any of those jurors didn't convict George Skates for thinking that he was involved in a conspiracy to commit aggravated riot. George Skates should be granted relief in this case and the indictments all dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shank. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.